This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 11th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, on the two-year anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster and tsunami, scrutiny continues to fall on nuclear power in the U.S., and environmental advocates call for a break to renewable resources. U.S. and Afghan officials clash over the role of U.S. Special Forces in Wardak Province. And in California, residents raise concerns about the controversial practice of hydraulic fracturing in the state. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today is the second anniversary of the Japanese earthquake and tsunami that caused the Fukushima nuclear meltdown. 3,000 workers continue the slow cleanup process at the plant. Last night, thousands of people showed their opposition to the use of nuclear power in a mass demonstration in Tokyo. Internet video shows marches and speakers addressing large crowds in a city park. More than 100 smaller anti-nuclear power events were reportedly planned elsewhere in the country. The Fukushima disaster 2 years ago served as a trigger for community mobilization in southern India. Small communities around the Kunankulam nuclear power plant in Tamil Nadu state have been trying to stop the facility from coming online and succeeded for several months to block construction. But now the Russian-Indian project is set to go live in April. On Sunday, the local administration began enforcing a month-long curfew in the villages surrounding the plant. But protesters defied those orders today. Local media reports hundreds of fishermen in boats flying black flags approached the plant from the sea, chanting slogans against nuclear power. Activists in Sri Lanka began mobilizations last week to oppose the plant, saying a nuclear disaster at Kundankulam would have disastrous effects on their country as well. The security situation in the Mexican border state due south of Texas appears to be deteriorating, FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
The state of Tamaulipas is arguably the most complex front of Mexico's drug war, and the situation seems to be going from bad to worse. Reynosa, a border city near McAllen, Texas, experienced an intense three-hour-long gunfight Sunday night. Criminals blockaded key parts of the city with cars, buses, and 18-wheelers. Just one day before, armed criminals stole vehicles from six area car dealerships. The firefight was described in real time by local Twitter users. The climate of violence and intimidation in Tamaulipas has made media reports from the ground rare. Another Tamaulipas border city, Nuevo Laredo, is experiencing a series of extreme circumstances. On Sunday, Mexico's Navy announced it had freed 104 Central American migrants who were presumably being held against their will by armed men in a local stash house. The press release made no mention of arrests, injuries, or fatalities in the operation carried out days before. Shannon Young, FSRN.
Christians in Pakistan protested in several cities after a major attack this weekend in Lahore. Christian schools were closed today in the entire Punjab province for fears of fresh violence. On Saturday, a group of Muslims burned about 100 homes in a Christian enclave of Lahore. Rumors had spread that a Christian made disrespectful remarks about the Prophet Muhammad. The Pakistani news outlet Dawn reports that 150 people have been arrested in connection with the attack. On Saturday, Kenya's Election Commission posted final results from last week's national vote. Winning by a slim margin was Uhuru Kenyatta, the son of the country's first prime minister. But he will not be sworn in until a legal challenge to the election results is heard. Raila Odinga, the current prime minister, came in second and immediately declared the results flawed. FSRN's John Bukali reports.
It has been exactly 1 week since 14 million Kenyans queued for hours to vote in national elections. Unlike 5 years ago, the elections and their aftermath have been generally peaceful. However, it took 6 days to announce the results after the electronic electoral system failed. Raila Odinga, the runner-up for president, points to this breakdown as one of the fundamental anomalies in the polls. He says he will challenge the results in court. Chief Justice Willy Mutunga today assured Kenyans that the Supreme Court is ready to hear the dispute.
I confirm that the judiciary is ready to hear these disputes impartially, fairly, justly, and without fear, ill will, favor, prejudice, or bias.
Once the case challenging the election results is formally lodged, the Supreme Court will have 2 weeks to issue a ruling. The government will then either hold new presidential elections or Kenyatta will be sworn in as the fourth president of Kenya. Odinga has said he will respect the ruling of the court. John Bwakali, FSRN, Nairobi.
Despite being the apparent president-elect, Uhuru Kenyatta is facing charges of crimes against humanity at the International Criminal Court for his role in the violence, displacements, and rapes that took place after the troubled 2007-2008 elections in Kenya. Today, the ICC dropped charges against another Kenyan official accused of the same crimes. ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda said witnesses against Francis Muthaura had been discredited and criticized the Kenyan government for not cooperating with the investigation. Bensouda said charges against the president-elect had not been dropped and that political developments in Kenya have no effect on the ICC case against Kenyatta. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Japan, millions of people across the country marked the anniversary of the devastating tsunami and nuclear disaster with memorial services and a moment of silence today. Some 300,000 residents remain displaced, more than half from the Fukushima prefecture. According to the Japan Times, more than 10,000 protesters filled the streets in Tokyo calling for an end to nuclear power. 2 years after the nuclear meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi reactor in Japan, U.S. regulators, lawmakers, scientists, and energy corporations continue to debate the future of nuclear power in this country, highlighting a number of serious safety issues at reactors in California, South Carolina, New York, and other states. Environmental advocates are pressuring government officials to shut down nuclear energy facilities and invest more in wind, solar, and other renewables. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Following the 2011 Fukushima disaster, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission launched a task force to study how to avoid a similar meltdown at the country's more than 130 operating reactors. On Monday, the second anniversary of the disaster, the commission announced it will start inspecting about 20 plants over the next few months to see how well they've implemented the task force's safety reforms. The NRC says they'll be making sure the reactors and nuclear waste containers are adequately prepared for earthquakes and floods. But Dr. Edwin Lyman with the Union of Concerned Scientists say many facilities are not, and a full third of U.S. nuclear reactors are at a serious risk of flooding from nearby dams.
The problem with a dam failure is that there may be very little warning to be able to prepare. So you could be faced with a situation similar to the tsunami in Japan. So certainly the plants in the southeast and Tennessee, some in the Midwest, are really vulnerable to flooding and they need to take much more rapid action to address that risk.
Federal regulators have also started requiring nuclear plants to have backup sources of energy, such as diesel generators, because a loss of power could cause the reactor to overheat. But Lyman says many aging U.S. facilities still risk leaking radioactive material into the surrounding environment, where it could remain for hundreds of years.
Once that containment is breached, then you can have widespread plumes of radioactive material into the atmosphere that then settle on residential areas and farmlands and water supplies into the groundwater, into nearby lakes or rivers or oceans. Any amount of radioactive exposure, no matter how small, is associated with an increase in cancer.
The Fukushima disaster also drew the attention of safety advocates to the dangers of earthquakes, especially for reactors in California, which experienced a 4.7 earthquake on Monday. New York's Indian Point, which sits along two geographic fault lines, is also at risk. The corporation Entergy, which operates Indian Point, recently asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to extend their license for another 20 years. But nuclear safety advocates in the region are calling on the agency to deny the extension. Instead, they want the plant shut down.
It is old, it's unsafe, it's environmentally destructive.
That's attorney Deborah Brancato with the environmental group Riverkeeper. They're pursuing legal challenges to the plant's license renewal with the Federal Commission and the New York State Department of Environmental Quality, which will hear the case this summer. Brancato says federal regulators should also give citizens more opportunities to weigh in on these decisions, especially the millions of New Yorkers who live within 50 miles of the Indian Point reactors.
We've encouraged the NRC to hold more public meetings on several issues that are of concern to the region, including Entergy's poor safety record in terms of fire safety.
Entergy spent nearly $4 million lobbying the federal government last year alone and gave nearly $500,000 to candidates in this past election, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. The biggest recipient was President Barack Obama, although the company gave more overall to Republicans. Some environmental advocates say this type of corporate lobbying could account for the agency's delay in implementing most of the post-Fukushima safety reforms. California Democrat Barbara Boxer called on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to provide her with a full report on the progress they've made and what still needs to be done. Citing newly released federal documents about the San Onofre reactor near San Diego, California, she expressed concern that the agency was allowing energy corporations to cut corners when it comes to safety. Boxer says members of the NRC will have to testify before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee at a hearing this April. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
FSRN reported recently on the leasing of nearly 18,000 acres of federal land in California for potential oil development. Governor Jerry Brown's administration and the oil industry are eager to exploit the oil that could be locked up in the Monterey Shale by using the controversial technology of hydraulic fracturing, fearing negative environmental and health impacts from fracking as documented in other states. Californians are asking hard questions about the rush for black gold. FSRN's Vic Bedoyan reports.
California oil producers have been using hydraulic fracturing for decades, mainly to extract oil from old wells. But the state only regulates wellhead operation, not the high-pressure injection process or the chemicals used in fracking. Now the potential of large-scale oil development in the Monterey Shale has brought forth a gusher of public concern. The state's lawmakers and regulators are rushing to come up with rules to govern fracking. Speaking at a recent public hearing on the issue, Senator Fran Pavley said there's a long list of unanswered questions.
Air and water quality, water supply, risk to agriculture, unknown seismic risks, and a variety of other issues. But the big question for the hearing today, at least in my mind, is the existing or proposed regulatory framework sufficient to regulate fracking with transparency and accountability to ease the public concerns?
Rising public apprehension about the possible impacts of fracking has already prompted action at the local level. In Santa Barbara, residents and lawmakers said they were shocked in 2011 when they discovered that the Vinoco Corporation was fracking in the county.
My board of supervisors heard from everybody. City dwellers, country dwellers, farmers, ranchers, vintners, water districts.
Doreen Farr is a Santa Barbara County supervisor. She said in the absence of state regulation, the county is moving ahead with local oversight. Farr told state senators that worries about fracking have galvanized widespread disapproval.
First, they were angry that something like this could happen without any warning. They wanted a thorough and transparent public process prior to the approval of a fracking operation. They wanted to know what the potential threats to causing seismic activity might be. They wanted to know how much fresh water would be required and how that might impact the productivity of their wells and affect sensitive environmental resources, particularly in the case of a groundwater basin that was already in a state of overdraft. But most importantly, everybody was extremely worried about groundwater contamination.
Virtually all the fracking operations in California take place in Kern County, one of the nation's major oil-producing areas. The Western States Petroleum Association reports in 2011 there were more than 600 wells being fracked by their members who produce 80% of the state's oil. The industry claims that wells are already regulated and no negative environmental or health impacts have been reported in the decades of fracking. Rock Zierman represents the California Independent Oil Producers Association. He cited an industry-funded study of fracking in the Los Angeles neighborhood of Baldwin Hills. It concluded the activity did not harm the environment or induce earthquakes.
This is one of the most studied operations, commercial operations in the country. And not only do we have a wealth of studies across the country, but we have California-specific studies on what we use, which is the conventional old-fashioned hydraulic fracturing.
Local activists have criticized the study cited by Zierman, according to the LA Times, saying that some involved are connected to the industry and it lacked independent scientific scrutiny. A primary concern is the connection between hydraulic fracturing and seismic activity. Ohio's governor shut down some wells after seismic events. In California, the Monterey Shale straddles the massive San Andreas Fault system. State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson noted that California's experts are no better at assessing risk than officials in states that have already had seismic events.
We built a nuclear power plant on a place with known faults and then just discovered within the past couple years it has additional faults. So I don't think we can say, well, we do better, you know, we're more on top of this game.
Water use in a water-starved state is another major constraint. The EPA estimates that each horizontal fracking well can use 2 to 5 million gallons of water. That concerns Andrew Grinberg of Clean Water Action. He says the proposed regulation doesn't go far enough to safeguard the public.
The discussion draft regulations do not even propose testing of groundwater or air, indicating a clear lack of initiative by our state regulators to implement meaningful safeguards.
In addition to concerns about negative environmental impacts, speculation abounds over the financial opportunities associated with fracking. Tupper Hull of the Western States Petroleum Association says there's a great deal of optimism about the potential for oil shale development and the economic boost it could bring. But the future is uncertain.
There remains a huge question, and that question is whether or not hydraulic fracturing, horizontal drilling, directional drilling, and other technologies will be as successful at developing that resource as it has been in other parts of the country. And I don't think that question's been answered yet.
While doubts may exist, it only took 10 minutes for the BLM to auction 18,000 acres of mineral leases, and they plan to auction more. Environmental groups like the Center for Biological Diversity are resisting the black gold rush by calling for a moratorium on fracking. Cassie Siegel is director of the center's Climate Law Institute. She is suing the state for failure to oversee fracking and the feds for leasing public land without full environmental studies. Siegel says California should look at the impacts of the fracking boom in other regions and be forewarned.
The Monterey Shale is not exactly like the shale formation in North Dakota, for example. But the oil companies are out there experimenting every day, trying to figure out the best way to exploit this formation in California. When they've done that in other parts of the country, we've seen areas transformed almost overnight, because once they figure out the best way to exploit this formation, there will be an oil boom.
Under public pressure, California's Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources produced draft regulations on fracking. The proposed rules are now being circulated for review and will be aired at a meeting in Bakersfield on March 13th. Meanwhile, four bills in the state legislature propose to broadly regulate fracking by requiring prior approval of wells, disclosure of chemical and water use, and tighter supervision by regulators. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN, Fresno.
Hi, this is Molly Stentz from WORTFM in Madison, Wisconsin. We rely on free speech radio news for in-depth coverage of human rights and social justice issues here in the United States and around the world. Our listeners count on FSRN to bring them stories and voices they won't hear anywhere else. Global stories, local voices. FSRN is an investment in independent news. But these voices could be silenced on the airwaves in just a few weeks. Find out how you can keep FSRN a strong voice in independent media at fsrn.org.
In Afghanistan today, U.S. forces killed two civilians on a road outside Kabul when their truck approached a U.S. convoy, according to Al Jazeera. Also in eastern Afghanistan, at least two coalition soldiers were killed when a person wearing an Afghan National Security Forces uniform opened fire, also killing several Afghans, according to Afghan government officials. The shooting took place in Wardak province, west of Kabul, where U.S. operations have drawn fierce criticism from Afghan officials for raids, detentions, and alleged human rights abuses. This weekend, a visit by U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel coincided with bombings that disrupted planned events, and news emerged that a 29-year-old university student was abducted and beaten by U.S.-backed forces Saturday. For more, we're joined by investigative journalist and historian Gareth Porter. His latest article at Interpress Service explores U.S. forces in Wardak. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks very much for having me.
About 2 weeks ago, after reports of abuse, raids, detentions, President Karzai ordered U.S. forces out of Wardak province. What is the role and presence of U.S. Special Operations Forces in Wardak at this point?
Well, what has happened since that statement by President Karzai 2 weeks ago is that instead of the Special Forces units in Wardak moving out of the province, U.S. officials began talking with Karzai, and apparently there was a joint Afghan-U.S. investigative unit or team formed, which was given the responsibility for going to Wardak and interviewing people in the province about their complaints about these mysterious Afghan militiamen who are associated, in the eyes of the people in Wardak at least, with the U.S. Special Forces units. And so as a result, you have both the discussions going on between U.S. and Afghan officials on one hand, and you have this joint investigation going on the other hand. Those two processes have basically continued beyond the 2 weeks now, without any result. And we still don't know at this moment whether the president is going to continue to insist that the special forces have to leave as a result of these processes or not.
As you note, we're now beyond the two-week notice that President Karzai did give in his speech, and these allegations are the subject of ongoing investigations. Interpress Service spoke to a villager in the region about such incidents. Could you describe the specifics of what they told you?
Well, this was my colleague, Shah Nouri, in Afghanistan, and one of the interviews was with a young man whose relatives told him about an incident in the village where he's a native, from which he's a native, which, according to the interview, was that these marauding outside Afghan forces, irregular forces, who again are of mysterious origin, and nobody knows exactly where they've come from, came into the village, and among other things, they forced one of the villagers to sit on an improvised explosive device, or an IED, and held a gun to his head. And they did this in front of other villagers, and the threat was made that if anyone in the village fired on or attacked any of these outside militiamen, that this individual would be killed, that they would blow him up.
Now, the U.S. signed a memorandum of understanding with Afghanistan in May 2012, and at the time, President Obama said it would mean Afghan control of forces. But you've pointed out a provision that allows U.S. support or training of Afghan forces to continue. Now, how could this affect U.S. role?
Well, right. I mean, this is a very little notice, and I would say, you know, hardly known at all aspect of this agreement that was reached last spring. The U.S. military inserted language in one of the provisions that basically defined the special operations, quote-unquote, which were covered by the agreement as being those operations that are brought to the government of Afghanistan and approved by a joint task force. Therefore, it's only those operations which the U.S. Special Forces decides
to allow to be covered by the agreement that are covered. And that means that, again, special forces are continuing to carry out the raids freely that they want to carry out. And so it goes to the heart of the central conundrum about U.S. policy in Afghanistan, that we're relying on the very operations that are most hated by the Afghan people.
Investigative journalist and historian Gareth Porter, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks again for having me.
And you can find a link to Gareth Porter's full article on our website, fsrn.org.
This is FSRN reporter Zach Brophy in Beirut, Lebanon. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories about the crisis in Syria. I've reported from the ground in Aleppo and have also covered the spillover of the conflict into Lebanon, from the influx of refugees to kidnappings. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how you can support independent grassroots journalism at fsrn.org. Global stories, local voices. FSRN is an investment in independent news. Again, you can learn more at fsrn.org.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Vampire holiday, the passing of Chavez. The death of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has brought out the malicious and carnal glee of the corporate press, who report breathlessly not only on his mortal passing, but an end to the Bolivarian Revolution. They are the voices of their vampire Wall Street bosses, who delight in owning more of the earth, no matter how much misery they may cause for millions. In fact, Chavez was beloved by the vast majority of Venezuelans, poor, Indian, and African, who saw in him their rising in the world. Upon his death, seven nations declared days of mourning in his honored memory: Cuba, Chile, Uruguay, Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Iran. Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, decreed 3 days of mourning and called Chavez an inspiration of the revolutionary transformation sweeping throughout Latin America. Argentina's president, Cristina Kirchner, also ordered 3 days of mourning to mark the passing of Chavez. For millions of Latin Americans, Chavez brought dignity to them by refusing to play the puppet for El Norte, the U.S. empire. He helped found ALBA, the International Latin American Bank, and became, in Fidel Castro's retirement, a son of his spirit who learned from his mentor how to resist the empire. How many of us know that Citgo provided low-cost heating oil to over 1.5 million Americans, and that Citgo, a wholly owned subsidiary of Venezuelan oil, did so with Chavez's blessing? When he took to the rostrum of the UN and said the devil was here yesterday and that the place smelled of sulfur, he was a global hit. Except for U.S. puppets. The devil was U.S. imperialism, still a dangerous, drone-invading, bomb-dropping threat to millions worldwide. Chavez, on the other hand, was loved and admired by millions, both in and out of Venezuela. Viva Hugo Chavez! From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.